Can you tell me a story?
Sure. Once upon a time, a mom needed a new car.
Was she brave?
She was tired, mostly. But she went to Carvana.com and found a great car at a great price. No secret treasure map required.
Did she have to fight a dragon?
Nope. She bought it 100% online. From her bed, actually.
Was it scary?
Honey, it was as unscary as car buying could be.
Did the car have a sunroof?
It did, actually.
Okay, good story.
Car buying you'll want to tell stories about. Buy your car today on
Carvana.
Delivery fees may apply.
Welcome back to On the Case, the podcast. I'm Paula Zahn, and thanks for joining us for Pod 27, A Predator in the Woods.
Tonight, we're on the case in Morristown, Tennessee, about 230 miles east of Nashville. The community is a picturesque slice of small-town America, and one of the last places you'd expect a savage attack on two teenage girls. And that made what happened to Mitzi Sizemore and Mary Jones even more shocking. The disturbing case put investigators in a race against time to catch a sadistic predator and bring justice to heartbroken loved ones.
July 20th, 1980. It was around 3 o'clock on a clear summer day when a then 33-year-old Jerry Barnard stepped onto his patio to get some fresh air. The chaotic moments that followed remain etched in his memory forever.
I heard a scream. I got my binoculars and looked over and seen a person come out of the woods.
Jerry was stunned. It was a badly injured teenage girl with a pair of handcuffs dangling from her wrist. Jerry called to a neighbor to get help while he headed out towards the woods armed with a rifle.
As I come this way, I seen someone laying over here in the edge of the woods. She opened her eyes and said, "I've been stabbed."
Jerry immediately knew he was in a race against time.
The teenager was near death and struggling to breathe. She told Jerry her name was Mitzi, and a man had just tried to kill her.
I said, "Let me get you out of here." So I carried her back over to my house.
As Jerry scooped the young woman up in his arms, she whispered another terrifying detail. She said her best friend Mary Jones was still in the woods with the man who attacked her. While an ambulance raced Mitzi to the hospital, police and Jerry headed into the woods to see if they could save her friend Mary. But when they found the teenager, it was already too late. Lead investigator, Martin Coffey.
I can remember it like it was yesterday. This young teenage girl, she has at least three stab wounds that I can see.
The evidence police discovered in the woods revealed a nightmare most couldn't imagine.
Even for veteran crime scene technicians, there was no way to prepare for the horror and brutality of what they had discovered.
I worked probably close to 1,000 crime scenes, but this one still haunts me.
Esko Jarnagin was the crime scene technician who responded to the call. The details from the scene remain seared in his memory.
She was lying face down. She was nude. She had four distinct stab wounds, and the fourth one was in the neck, in what we normally call the jugular vein. You could tell that the knife had been twisted, like it was meant to kill her.
As investigators studied the area surrounding Mary Jones' lifeless body, a grim picture of her last moments alive quickly came into focus.
She was a young red-haired girl who was laying face down with a white sock stuffed into her mouth.
It appeared Mary had tried to escape from a sexually motivated attacker.
They had discovered her shorts, maybe 30 yards from there, up across the fence.
Not only had she been savagely stabbed, it was also clear it was a sexually motivated attack.
That's what's going through my mind as I'm seeing part of her clothing pulled up over the top of her head, part of her clothing in another area in the crime scene. This really looks like a sexual assault murder case.
One in which the victim fought desperately for her life. Police found out looking for her assailant.
There was an intense search for the perpetrator. The time of day was probably about 6:30 or 7 o'clock. We had about a couple hours worth of daylight left. It's going to get dark on us soon.
The nature of the crime only added to the urgency police were feeling.
We just don't normally have sexual assaults and murders in our small community in Morristown.
But the search proved fruitless. Police found no sign of Mary's killer. Still, lead Detective Martin Coffey hoped there was something in the woods that might help identify the suspect.
The initial was, we want to make sure he's not here. But if he's not here, then what did he leave behind?
The search of the crime scene and surrounding area had been intense, with officers combing the vicinity for hours.
We combed the area looking for any type of clues or evidence whatsoever. Even though it was an area that was kind of grown up somewhat, I mean, you've got officers there prepared to search.
But they were unable to find the murder weapon.
And detectives found no other evidence that connected Mary's killer to the savage attack. In fact, police believe they might need a medical miracle to move the investigation forward.
The second victim, and now the most critical witness, was clinging to life in the hospital, and the prognosis for her survival was bleak.
That was a real concern. She has multiple stab wounds, and they're in the chest. Will she be able to talk to me? And if so, what kind of information would I be able to get?
Investigators had no other option than to wait and hope that the young woman would pull through.
She wasn't expected to live. I mean, when she was taken down the ambulance at the hospital, she probably was given a 10% chance to live because she'd lost so much blood. It was just touch and go.
I was really concerned about, would she live? And would I be able to talk to her in advance if she didn't live? Would we be able to get any information from her, you know, that would help us to identify this person who had violated both these young girls?
And while everyone on the case prayed for Mitzi, detectives also had to prepare for the most somber task in law enforcement, telling Mary Jones' loved ones about the tragedy in the woods.
There were five children in the Jones family. Mary was closest with her older sister, Patty. The two were 3 years apart, and the relationship had always felt more like best friends than sisters. Patty will never forget the day her family received that phone call with the devastating news.
The phone rang, and I answered it. And a man asked me if I was Patty. And he said, "Is your sister Mary Jones?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, she's been murdered."
Patty heard the words, but she wasn't able to process what she was being told.
I remember screaming, and I asked him what had happened, and he said she was stabbed to death.
For Patty and the rest of Mary's loved ones, the trip to the hospital was a mind-numbing blur that suddenly turned all too real when they were asked to identify her body.
My parents couldn't do it because they were just way too upset. We were all there, and I was going to go identify her, and then my uncle, he said, "I'll do it." So he went in. He was forever changed He never was the same after he saw her.
In fact, life for everyone in the Jones family would have a void that could never be filled.
Mary's brother, J.D. Jones.
I was young, 8 years old, not knowing what was going on. I just knew, you know, she was dead and gone.
I just remember, you know, holding on to Mom. And she broke down and, you know, we was both crying.
For the Joneses, family was everything. It was instilled in Mary from a very young age.
She was real sweet. She was like the peacemaker in our family. She always wanted to do the right thing, and she was just a good little sister.
Mary and Patty were extremely close. They confided in each other, sharing their hopes and dreams for the future they imagined.
Well, I know she wanted to be a mother. She wanted her own family. I had my first daughter, and she was like a year old, and Mary loved her so much, and she would like carry her around the neighborhood all the time and play with her.
The Jones family had been robbed of Mary's joyful presence and tender heart, and their loss was compounded by the painful questions the crime left unanswered.
Mary's sister, Loretta Warner.
I had no clue who could have done something so horrible. I mean, why? That was my biggest question, why? Why would anybody want to hurt him?
Investigators on the case were trying to figure out that answer, but there was little to go on until the autopsy results came in.
Sadly, the medical examiner's report confirmed what officers on the scene had theorized was the motive for the crime.
She was victimized as a sexual assault.
A small amount of biological evidence was recovered.
DNA is probably the most blissful thing that has ever been incorporated into law enforcement, but that was prior to that. At the time, we conceded that this is going to be a difficult case to solve, but we gathered everything for the simple reason being you can never have too much gathering of evidence.
Meanwhile, back at the crime scene, investigators were still searching for some clue that would put them on the trail of Mary's killer.
We found some fiber on the fence that used to be here.
It was a stroke of luck. The fiber they found was just a tiny thread, which could have easily been overlooked.
It was just a strand of fiber, like something off of a pair of pants that maybe just a few threads and hanging down, maybe 6 or 8 inches.
But detectives on the scene knew that regardless of how small the fiber was, it could still be of critical evidentiary value.
I didn't know if it came from Mary's shorts, but it didn't appear to be the same material that came from Mary's shorts. So it being different material and being different material to what I understood the first victim had, then yeah, there was a concern that this could be a critical piece of evidence. We need to collect it. It's something we need to preserve.
But perhaps even more importantly, the strand of cloth helped police patch together a theory of what happened in the woods that day. Investigators believed Mary heard screams and went to see what was happening.
I think Mary crossed the fence to see what was taking place. And by the time she realized what was taking place, she takes off to run. He runs after her at that point and grabbed her, takes her to the ground. He takes off her shorts. At that point, somehow she gets away from him and she gets across the fence and she's running.
Police believe Mary's attacker chased after her, catching his pants on the top of the fence as he climbed over it.
He gets across the fence, he's running after her, and he's stabbed her in the back. She succumbs to her knife wound and she falls to the ground.
That fence separated the woods from a roadway where Mary might have gotten help, but she never made it there.
He manages to chase her down. He's faster than she is. And there is where he stabbed her 4 different times, killing her.
Investigators had to contain their emotions. It was difficult to know just how close Mary had come to reaching safety. But Mary didn't escape, and now there was a deranged predator on the loose.
The thing that really was so shocking was the feeling of security of living in a small town. Suddenly, that's taken away.
On the Case, the podcast will continue in a moment. As detectives made their way back from the crime scene, they got some good news from the hospital. Mary's best friend Mitzi had made it through surgery, and amazingly, she was ready to talk. But would she be able to help them find Mary's killer? Doctors said it had been a miracle that she had even survived surgery and warned police that the trauma she suffered might impact how much she remembered. First and foremost, those working the case were thankful she was alive.
Lead investigator Martin Coffey.
Extremely relieved that she was not only going to survive, but that she was able to actually talk to us. That was a real concern because I knew she had the information that we needed, because if we could get something from her, then we'd have a place to start.
The young woman had just endured a traumatic attack. Investigators didn't know what to expect when they spoke with her. The interview would be a sensitive balancing act.
We knew we only had a few minutes and didn't know what she might actually know, especially with regards to her close friend who was already dead. And we didn't want to give that information to her and make her even more emotionally traumatized. So as we walked in, we let her tell her story as she was able to tell us.
She began by telling detectives about how she and Mary first crossed paths with their attacker.
She talked about how he had stopped along the road, and he said he was a police officer and that he was looking for these 2 runaways.
From her hospital bed, the teenager explained how a man who claimed to be a police officer approached her and her best friend Mary on their way to Cherokee Park. Now, 40 years later, Mitzi recounts those terrifying moments in this phone interview.
He shows his badge, his identification. That's what made us believe he was a police officer. And said he was looking for these 2 runaways and told us their names.
The off-duty police officer asked the 2 teenagers if they might be able to help him.
Mitzi had said that she knew them, had gone to school with them, and it was obvious that these were 2 real people. So she believed his story as he began to tell them that he was a police officer.
Mary and Mitzi told the officer they had not seen the 2 runaways, nor did they have any idea where they might be, so he drove away. Then, a few hours later, as the teenagers were leaving the park, the friendly officer circled back with them.
And at the time that he reapproaches them, he tells them that he's got a lead on where they're at.
He said that he had spotted them when they were camped out and wanted to know, since we knew them, if we would help him talk them out, coming out of the woods so that they could get them home.
Mitzi and Mary agreed to go with him.
This is 2 15 and 16-year-old young ladies, and they're being approached by somebody who flashes a badge. It looks like a detective. He's talking about real people that they really know. His story is very convincing. So they believe him, believe they're helping these people that they consider to be friends because they've ran off together. He needs to locate them and bring them back home. They get in the vehicle thinking they're doing the right thing.
Sheriff Esko Jarnigan.
They didn't question it because the pieces fit. He had done his homework. He was believable. It's not their fault that they believed him and they got in the vehicle with him.
The man drove to a neighborhood a few miles away and parked in an empty cul-de-sac. He asked Mitzi to come into the woods with him to talk with the runaway couple.
He told Mary to stay there because too many of them might scare these two runaways off.
And he said, why don't you go out there and try to talk them out? I'll show you where they're at. As I started, he held down the fence for me to cross over. And as soon as I crossed over that fence, he grabbed me.
The fence Mitzi described was the same one where police had found fibers of what they believed was the killer's clothing. Mitzi told police that once he grabbed her, she instinctively knew that she would have to fight to survive.
I flipped around and started fighting. I clawed his face. I hit him. I fought him with everything he had in me. I was little. He had a pair of handcuffs. And he handcuffed my left wrist. And he jumped on me. And he held a gun to my head.
He told her not to scream, but she started screaming anyway. At that point, she's struggling with him, realizing that she's in trouble, but not being able to get herself out of this bind because he's a little stronger than she is.
The whole time, I was screaming, Brian, Mary, go get help. And I was hoping she would hear me. He kept saying, I'm not going to hurt you. I'm not going to hurt you. And I said, then why are you doing this? Well, he reached down, unbuttoned and unzipped my shorts. All of a sudden, I seen something silver. He came down with a knife and cut my throat. I thought, play dead, Mitzi, play dead. So I acted like I was choking. On my breath because I was bleeding pretty bad.
He says, you've had it, and stabs her into the chest, I believe collapsing one of the lungs.
Just then, Mitzi's attacker was distracted by noises in the woods behind him. And he realized that 16-year-old Mary Jones was watching him from a distance.
Before he took off running, he reached around and handcuffed my other hand around a tree. Couldn't believe what was happening. I mean, here we were, thought we was helping a police officer. Now I'm laying handcuffed to a tree, my throat sliced.
Mary had crossed over the fence, and he, at some point, took after Mary.
Mitzi was on the ground bleeding and badly injured. When her attacker left her alone, she remembered hearing screams in the nearby woods.
She's hearing someone scream. I don't know if she is really able to realize at that moment that that's Mary Jones.
Meanwhile, Mitzi knew she was bleeding to death. She desperately tried to free herself from the handcuffs before she lost consciousness.
She knew she had a moment to be able to try and get her hands out of the handcuffs.
I tried to get the handcuff off my left hand, and it was just way too tight. And I worked and worked and worked with the handcuff on my right wrist and finally got it out.
The 15-year-old then stumbled through the dense forest, praying for help.
Something just told me, it's not your time, Mitzi. It's not your time. You're going to have to fight to live.
She ran through the woods down into a field, obviously screaming. She then hears someone coming up and thinks it's the perpetrator returning to perhaps finish her off. So she pretends to be dead. And it turns out it's the neighbor who had seen her.
He's my guardian angel. God brought him out there. It was a miracle.
more on The Case the Podcast after this. The doctors had cautioned police that the trauma may have an impact on what the young woman was able to remember. But the details she provided law enforcement were astounding. Lead investigator Martin Coffey.
She remembered a lot. She described her perpetrator. She described about how he hadn't shaved for a few days.
And that description of the man who nearly killed her is perhaps Mitzi's most tormenting memory.
He had strawberry blonde hair. He had medium build, big old bug eyes. His eyes is what I remember so well. Bugged out of his head. I looked him face to face, fighting with him and pleading with him to stop doing what he was doing. But his eyes, I see him. Every day, I close my eyes and I see his face.
Mitzi also remembered the truck the man had been driving.
It was a little yellow pickup truck. It had fishing rods in the back.
The details of Mitzi's story led police to several chilling conclusions. The man who murdered Mary Jones was a member of the community with law enforcement training and someone who was likely on the hunt for his next victim. That meant no young girl in Morristown, Tennessee was safe until he was brought to justice.
The feeling of security, trust, those things that are so valuable, I think were taken from people.
Thanks to Mitzi's courage, investigators now had a solid description of the perpetrator and the pickup truck he was driving. It was the first solid lead investigators were able to pursue.
We were hopeful, but it turned out there were a lot more yellow trucks in Hamline County than you would imagine because we had officers most of the night chasing down yellow trucks. There were a bunch of stops that were made that night.
But until the deadly predator was caught, the small, tightly knit community of Morristown, Tennessee was living in terror.
Oh, the fear was very significant because you just don't have this sort of thing occur there. And I think it takes away, again, the trust of, can I let my child out of my house to go to walk in the neighborhood? Is it really safe?
Police quickly shared the information Mitzi had provided with the public.
At the time, we were able to release a lot of information, and the local radio station was broadcasting it continually. This was a very shocking crime that occurred in our community. So there's a lot of media coverage. I think they even went into a description that she did about his teeth being yellow from smoking too much.
The huge amount of attention given to Mary's murder generated another important lead.
There were all sorts of tips about yellow trucks and things of that sort. But the most important tip that we got was the call about the runaways, and we were able to go and find them. That was critical.
Mary's killer had lured the two young girls to the crime scene, asking them for help in bringing the runaway couple home. Now, Detective Coffey asked those runaways if they knew anyone who matched Mitzi's description.
The person who had the information was the young boy. The description was all over the news, and he said, I think I know two people who meet this description. But he tells us only one of them has a yellow pickup truck. Well, that's the direction we started.
And the young teen who spoke with police also went a step further.
He gave us a name.
The teenager gave detectives the name Randy May, a friend who worked at a nearby service station. It was the first time anyone working on the case had heard the name. Police were intrigued. And when detectives delved into his background, the lead only got more promising.
It turned out that he had actually applied for jobs in law enforcement all over the place, in every surrounding county. But his name didn't mean anything to me at that moment. So what we did was we figured out where he lived, and we drove over there to see if we could find Mr. May.
It turned out that May was studying part-time for a degree in criminal justice at the local community college. Investigators suspected that would have given him insight into how to impersonate an officer. Detective Coffey and his partner headed to May's home to question him.
We went up, knocked on the door, and his wife was home, and she said he was at work. But as we were backing out, leaving the residence, we can see there's a small yellow truck there.
The truck was a critical piece of the puzzle. And when investigators track May down at work, his hair color appeared to be another.
We went out to the service station where he was at work. And when we got there, he's got the strawberry blonde hair. So there are flags going up, you know, one right after the other. So we just ask him, care to go spend a few minutes with us at the sheriff's department? He agrees.
If May was actually nervous, he did a good job of hiding it from the detectives.
He was surprisingly calm, more so than I would have thought, talking up storm to us.
May told Detective Coffey that on the afternoon of Mary Jones' murder, he had actually been fishing in the area where she and Mitzi were approached by the man in the yellow truck. But May claimed something very strange had happened.
He starts talking about how he takes his truck over into the lake and somehow he leaves his key in there and he doesn't necessarily notice anything at that moment.
May said it took several hours before he realized that someone had been inside his truck.
He goes home, mows his lawn, and happens to wash the truck. And then he comes to the sheriff's department to report that somebody's tampered with his truck.
May claimed his truck was taken by a thief who actually stole several items that afternoon. But because the suspect returned the truck, May hadn't realized until after he had washed it.
He's missing his knife, and a few other things are missing, and he doesn't know what happened to them.
Detective Coffey was stunned. It appeared that May was trying to explain away evidence that would connect him to the crime.
Bells and whistles are going off.
Detectives checked into May's story. They found no record he had visited the sheriff's office that day, nor a report filed about the stolen items. May couldn't even provide the name of a deputy to confirm his account.
He can't remember actually who he talked to and has no record of such a thing.
Investigators were convinced May's story was nothing more than a desperate attempt to distance himself from the brutal attacks on Mitzi and Mary. But they still weren't certain they could prove it.
I don't have enough evidence to be able to effectively arrest him at this point, so I need him to talk.
A complicated game of cat and mouse was now underway. And detectives knew they still needed May to agree to let them search his home. They were certain it would reveal the physical evidence they needed to arrest him. But that meant they had to carefully avoid tipping May off about their suspicions.
We asked him to take a look at the house. He agrees.
Not only did May agree to let the detective search the home, he joined them inside.
In fact, he's kind of helpful in the search. So we began to kind of collect items as we were looking for things.
Police asked May if he owned a pistol.
We had asked him about weapons. He takes me to the back bedroom and pulls the .45 out from between the mattress and the box springs.
The .45 caliber pistol was identical to the one Mitzi said her attacker had. The gun in the badge he displayed that afternoon had convinced her that he was actually a policeman. detectives also collected an empty handcuff case. The evidence appeared to connect May to the crime, but Detective Coffey's game plan was to convince May that his explanation for each item police collected was believable.
I'm sure there was a lot running through his mind, but he would have a story for whatever we were going to find. He's been taking law enforcement classes. He wanted to relate to us as if we were fellow cops.
And detectives were happy to play along. They just wanted to keep May calm and let him talk. The camaraderie the want-to-be officer felt with the police made the process easier.
Whether I believe you or not, well, that's another story. But I'm prepared to let you talk because he's giving us more information. With each passing thing he gives us, we have something else to work with.
After the search was completed, May agreed to return to the sheriff's office to answer additional questions. Detectives began by asking him about the empty handcuff case. It appeared as though the officers had caught him off guard.
Suddenly, he remembers his handcuffs are missing as well. Somebody's tampered with his truck. They've taken his handcuff keys and his handcuffs, and, you know, he just didn't realize.
May's impossible-to-believe story turned the seemingly friendly interview into a full-blown interrogation.
It's time to change the tone, kind of up the ante. It's time to actually, you know, confront him with the facts that we have. It's time to go from, let's let you ramble and talk, to, I don't really believe what you're telling me.
On the Case, the podcast will continue in a moment.
Police pressed May about how each clue connected him to the attack on Mitzi Holt Sizemore and the murder of Mary Jones. Under the withering barrage of questions, Randy May suddenly cracked.
Lead investigator Martin Coffey.
His entire story began to change, and suddenly he does tell us about having talked to the two girls, and he begins to tell us about what actually happened.
Most of the terrifying story May told police matched the one Mitzi Holt Sizemore had shared from her hospital bed.
He had seen the two girls walking along the road, and he had approached them with this story that he was looking for two runaways.
May admitted he identified himself as a police officer and asked the two girls for their help getting two high school runaways to come home.
And he knows this is a very viable story with them because he knows they know them.
Police had no doubt that the crime was premeditated.
There's very little question in my mind. His story was too convincing. He had too much equipment on him. Who walks around with a badge and an ID holder and a set of handcuffs and a .45 and a story about two runaways that you can present to two young girls? And, you know, he's researched this. So when he approaches them, he's giving them a story with things that would help reinforce their belief that he's actually a law enforcement officer.
As May talked about the two young girls, the motive for the attack quickly came into focus.
He begins to describe the two girls, talking about Mary Jones having red hair, but he talks about Mitzi more so. He talks about her being really cute. She's the target of his affection.
To make his twisted fantasy come to life, May drove Mitzi and Mary to a remote location where he knew there would be no witnesses.
He's cased it. He knew where he was going.
May then explained how he separated the girls from one another, convincing Mary to wait in the truck while he took Mitzi into the woods to sexually assault her.
He follows through with what he's planned. He gets Mitzi into an area where he thinks he's got her under control. He attacks her.
Even seasoned detectives had trouble listening to him relive
the sadistic plan he actually made a reality.
But May's confession left out the most gruesome details.
He could remember taking Mitzi across the fence and then grabbing her from behind. He remembers the handcuffs, but doesn't remember any of the actual stabbing of her.
During his confession to the murder of Mary Jones, May also claimed he couldn't remember how he ended her life.
He claims to remember taking Mary Jones into the woods, and he remembers cleaning off his knife and leaving the scene. Why would you be cleaning off your knife?
Police and Randy May returned to his home, where he led them to additional physical evidence he had hidden on his property.
He agreed to take us to the badge and the ID holder, the knife, and the handcuff keys.
Investigators already had enough to arrest Randy May. But detectives knew there was still one piece of the puzzle left to seal the case against him.
There were a lot of questions asked about whether we'd done a lineup with Mitzi. So we did an in-person lineup there at the Sheriff's Department. When Mitzi stepped up to take a look at him, I mean, it was one of those scenarios where you actually watch somebody relive a moment. And she picks him out immediately.
The sheer terror of facing Randy May is something Mitzi Holt-Sizemore will never forget.
I was shaking all over. I was scared to death. There was no doubt in my mind it was him. He was the one that attacked me.
At that point, it was pretty obvious that this case was over, because no defense attorney in the world would have wanted to have got her on the stand and talk about what he's done to her and to her friend.
Detective Coffey's impressions were prophetic. Randy May offered to plead guilty in exchange for a lesser sentence. Mary's family supported the move. The family would not have to be put through a drawn-out trial. It was a small consolation, but they were grateful that they would not have to endure even more pain. Mary's sister, Loretta Warner.
I would try and protect Mom and Daddy from the details. So I was glad that he got 30 years without a chance for parole.
But under Tennessee law, the terms of May's sentence were far different than what was read in the courtroom.
Rebecca Hale, victim advocate.
We do not have truth in sentencing. With the way the Tennessee Department of Corrections works, he can receive credits for taking classes and credits for good behavior. A life sentence is a percentage of life. And his is 30%.
That meant that just 6 years into his sentence, May would have a shot at parole. It was a stunning legal loophole that none of Mary's family had been aware of. When Mary's loved ones learned of May's actual sentence under the plea deal, they were furious.
Oh, man, I was really mad. We got it on the ball, and we got a bunch of petitions signed. We had a peaceful protest and a candlelight vigil.
It's a process that Mitzi and Mary's family have had to endure over and over again.
Every time he has a parole hearing, the family has to appear in court to argue against his release, which means they have to face May and relive the horrible ordeal over and over again. It's as if May's initial act of brutality and torture have never stopped.
Mary's sister, Patty Konkin.
He has sat within 4 feet from me. I could reach out and touch him and nothing between us. It's really hard, a lot of emotions.
But now the emotion only helps to strengthen their resolve. they continue to fight for justice for Mary.
It consumes all of our time. Every time we would finish, we would have to start thinking of what we were going to do the next year.
Mary's brother, J.D. Jones.
It feels like going in, we have to continue to prove that he's guilty. I hope at the parole hearings that when he walks in, he can feel the hate I have for him. Even if he dies in prison, he's not paid his debt.
And for Mitzi Holt Sizemore, it's a scar that will never heal.
It's exhausting. It's horrible to have to relive it. But I made a vow to Mary, as long as there was breath in me, that I would go.
And the loss of her closest friend still weighs heavily on her.
There's not been a day that has passed since this has happened that I haven't thought about it, that I haven't thought about my friend Mary.
During parole hearings, Mitzi recounts what happened to her every single time in vivid detail, and her story never wavers. It's gut-wrenching to watch her retell this story, relive it, not heal from it, and be afraid.
He said he's going to come back and kill me. I truly believe if they let him out, that he will try to come kill me. I'll never have a normal life.
While the parole hearings remain tormenting, they feel they're also a chance to keep Mary's memory alive.
She fought for her life, so we fight for her, even though we can't bring her back. We continue her fight.
Thanks for listening. Please don't forget to follow, rate, and review. And if you want more information on today's case, visit facebook.com/paulazanofficial or just click the link in the episode description. I'm Paula Zahn. Please join us again next Wednesday when we're back on the case, the podcast.